Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, March 5th, welcome, 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 friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry,
uh-huh.
What's the last concert you went to?
The last concert I went to, New Edition.
New Edition? How was it?
It was great.
Was it expensive?
Yes, but I did not pay for the tickets. My husband bought the tickets, but we were on the floor, so they were not cheap.
Was it worth it?
It was a great concert. Yeah,
they still have it.
Yeah, yeah.
New Edition still has it.
They still got it. Yes, they do.
Look, you go to a concert like a New Edition show. Mm-hmm. You have a great time.
Yep.
Maybe at that point, your sort of anger evaporates about how much you had to pay.
Yep.
But if you don't have a great time, you might be dwelling on that price, right?
Because
more and more expensive to go see live music these days and all sorts of live events. And that kind of price consciousness is at the heart of a trial happening right now. The federal government against Live Nation, which owns Ticketmaster. And these are monopoly allegations against Live Nation, which controls many aspects of the music industry. We're going to dive into the case today. We're also going to get to the bigger question of why it costs so much to go to a concert these days.
Lots of questions, because it is getting extremely expensive. Yeah.
And so we want to hear from you, of course, as always. Tell us about your favorite concert experience. How much did you pay? Was it worth it? Let's take a little trip down memory lane.
Yeah.
Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2 at whyy.org. If you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook, put your comments in the chat.
And you know what, Avi? I know I'm going to put this out there because I know we're going to get some callers who are going to rub it in about the
how cheap it used to be.
It used to be $20, and they were on the front row or something crazy. $8.
Oh, absolutely.
And they were on the front row of their and they saw their favorite rock band or something.
I was at Woodstock. It was free.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So go ahead. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. The phone lines are open. Tell us all about it. I'm looking forward to that.
My uncle did go to Woodstock.
Oh, really?
There. Yeah, he was there.
It was free?
Yeah, I mean, you had to go. It was a lot of trouble getting there. It wasn't easy. But he said it was a good time.
Well, and it's Thursday, which means it's DJ of the day, too. This is a perfect DJ of the day setup.
Yeah, I guess live music in general, nostalgia for cheaper prices. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we're
a lot
of
options.
We're going to end the show today with a song picked by one of you on the topic of today's show. Email executive producer Kevin, studio2@whyy.org with your song suggestion, and we'll shout out one of you and play your song at the end of the show.
Looking forward to that. So now we have our trio of news stories, and I'll jump right in. Top story today. Families are being forced to turn to the states for civil rights support after the Trump administration dismantled the Department of Education. Interesting write-up by the Associated Press about a group of black families in Bucks County who filed complaints with the Department of Education after their kids experienced racialized bullying at their mostly white school in the Penn Ridge School District. They thought the complaint would fix things, but instead it just was added to the pile of thousands of complaints sitting in a federal office, hoping to get some attention following major layoffs by the Trump administration. So they're now turning to the state. And in Pennsylvania, State Senator Lindsey Williams is proposing a new state agency that would investigate schools and enforce the civil rights of students. The odds are not really in her favor because the GOP controls the Senate, but she thinks her bill could become a national model since lawmakers from Maryland and Illinois have already made inquiries. In Pennsylvania, we have the Human Relations Commissions, but they don't really do education complaints,
civil rights complaints.
So there is some kind of mechanism needed. And in other Democratic-led states, they're looking to push state agencies that are already in place to do some of this work.
To backfill the work that the feds are not doing anymore.
Yeah.
The Department of Education, as it was noted at the time when it was being sort of dismantled and gutted, doesn't have a lot of control over education. In this country, a lot of control is held at the local level and the state level. But this is one thing that the feds did do traditionally, these types of civil rights investigations. And if they're not going to do them, of course, it begs the question, who will? If states step in, the question I would have is, what would be their enforcement mechanism? Because the feds would, their threat was, we'll withhold federal dollars, Title I money, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The states have plenty of money to withhold from school districts, but would they do that? Would they be comfortable stepping into that role? That's a big question moving forward.
Yeah, so interesting. And this is becoming a major issue. I interviewed Nicole Hannah-Jones a couple of weeks ago for Studio 2 Extra, and she was sort of sounding the alarm because a lot of the enforcement mechanisms within the DOJ even have also been slashed as well.
Absolutely. Story number two, late last month, reportedly over a dozen Philadelphia police officers investigated a queer-owned sports bar on South Street responding allegedly to anonymous tips. And now the owner of that bar tells our news partner 6ABC that the bar was unfairly targeted. The bar is Marsha's. It's been open less than a year. It's fairly new. Police came to the bar on February 20th after they say they received complaints that Marsha's was operating without proper licenses, serving underage patrons, and selling alcohol after hours. Now, according to owner Siobhan Anderson, 18 to 20 police officers showed up. They found no violations. Mm-hmm. And Anderson says this is the second anonymous tip made against Marsha's within a month. Anderson told 6ABC, quote, "We were kind of prepared for this because unfortunately, haters gonna hate."
Yeah, 18 to 20 officers seems a little excessive to me. And I visited Marsha's and it probably only holds up to 50 or 60 people. So it's not
space,
a big space. But Siobhan Anderson, like you said, she was prepared. She came out swinging. She posted a video, on Instagram and on other social media, got
a lot of attention.
And the community sort of rallied behind them as they worked to build their business. But, you know, we talked about this earlier. I mean, there is a history of queer-owned bars or queer-run bars being harassed by police, having folks call and making false complaints about them. And you thought, you know, you kind of think, it's 2026, you know, the city has moved forward. A lot of this doesn't exist. And yet they were ready because they didn't know, and it did happen to them.
Right. I mean, going all the way back to Stonewall, right? That is sort of the origin of the Stonewall riots, police raiding a gay bar in New York City. So you're right. Like, you have to be cognizant of that history when you think about a story like this. Of course, it's an anonymous tip, so we don't know.
It
could be someone with a personal grudge. It could be someone who doesn't like their business practices for some other reason. That's the problem here. You don't know, and you're maybe never going to know.
Yeah.
And I do think the police should at least address why there were so many officers.
Yeah, 18 to 20 for a space that can only hold about 60.
Yeah, because that's an area where we could get some answers, mm-hmm. I would imagine. Anyways, story number three, a story about a bar, but it's a happier story. Don't worry, go ahead.
In a sign that women's sports are blowing up in Philly, the city is slated to get its very first dedicated women's sports hub this June. It's called the Stoop Pigeon, and it's a 2,300 square foot venue that will be located in the heart of Center City at Broad Street.
Yes. Right on Broad Street. How about that?
And according to its founders, it will serve as a gathering space for fans to watch games, host live podcasts, attend panel discussions, and just celebrate women's sports. By day, the Stoop Pigeon will operate as a cafe and will transition to a sports bar in the evening. And throughout the day, you can watch women's sports.
So we got the women's sports bar on Broad Street,
mm-hmm.
which very soon after will be a place where you can watch a parade on Broad Street as our WNBA team brings home the title. I'm putting it out there in the universe.
I mean, the momentum is building around women's sports.
Absolutely.
In the city.
And by the way, some of their menu items are tributes to great female athletes and coaches. They have the Dawn Staley Paley Ailey.
Ooh,
that's pretty good.
I like that.
They've got the Vivian Shoestringer fries in homage to the former Rutgers and Cheney coach C. Vivian Stringer. So I love sports and I love wordplay. So this really is perfect for me.
Yeah.
Could I make a couple other suggestions?
Go ahead, suggest.
And these are just suggestions, a first draft, really.
Yes.
How about you take, you do mozzarella sticks,
mm-hmm.
but you put like an apostrophe between the O and the Z as an homage to Monet Davis.
Monet!
Yeah.
Oh, that's so
like
good.
Like mozzarella sticks.
And she's now, by the way, playing professional baseball.
That's right.
Women's baseball.
One more. Okay, so you know, there's a great women's coach, basketball coach from South Jersey named Cheryl Reeve. And you could have the whole like appetizer portion of the menu be share plates.
Ooh.
How about that?
You know what, Avi? Shout out. We got to say Lori Albright and Jen Leary, co-founders of the Stoop Pigeon.
These are just ideas. I mean,
he got the ideas.
Truly, I mean, this is truly, I'm not, you guys are doing a great job already. I just want to contribute to this great project. They also have Mighty Mac Margaritas, which are named after the trailblazing women's basketball team from Immaculata, University. Look them up. The Mighty Max. Do your research. Know your history.
And you got to come up with
early
something.
Women's basketball team.
We got to come up with something for Natasha Cloud, too.
Ooh, that's a good one.
Because Cloud, that sounds like it could be like
that
some
could be
kind
like
of
a mixed drink.
Yeah,
or,
I feel like, yeah. And that's off the top. See, I'm trying to.
Like maybe a molecular gastronomy thing with the cloud.
With the cloud on there. Some
cotton candy.
Some dry ice.
Yeah. Okay.
We coming up. We're hooking y'all up.
Now that we're rolling, we'll transition to our big discussion today, which is about the cost of live music and the monopoly power of Live Nation. Give us a call if you have thoughts on this. 888-477-9499.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. A major antitrust case kicked off this week. Live Nation and its subsidiary, Ticketmaster, are on trial facing allegations they monopolized the live music industry, bullied venues, and hurt consumers and artists with predatory ticketing and promotion tactics.
This comes after decades of complaints by artists, venues, and fans alike. In the 90s, rock band Pearl Jam was famously locked out of many major music venues after refusing to work with Ticketmaster, which they felt was driving up ticket prices for fans. A few years ago, Taylor Swift fans were up in arms about Ticketmaster, site crashes, and scalping of tickets for her Eras Tour. Remember that?
With us to unpack this case and how we got here is Krista K. Brown, senior correspondent on the corporate investigations team at the Capitol Forum. Krista, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR music reporter. Isabella, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we want to hear from you, our listeners on the road, at home, or elsewhere. Our question of the day, tell us about your favorite concert experience. How much did you pay? And was it worth it? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our streamers on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the live chat.
Let's start with a caller. This is Julia from East Norriton Township on line one. Hey, Julia, you're on Studio 2. I'm curious about your favorite concert experience.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you so much. It's funny that Cherry just mentioned Pearl Jam and them testifying before Congress many decades ago, actually, because my favorite concert experience, I actually saw Pearl Jam close out the Spectrum. So it was October 31st, 2009.
Wow.
And I was in the front row because I have been a fan club member of Pearl Jam for decades now at this point, and they offer premium seats to their fan club members.
Oh,
so you have an opportunity, it's like a lottery system, and you have an opportunity to secure tickets in the best seats in the house at all the venues that they play at. And I think that Pearl Jam instituted that fan club, you know, ticket option kind of mitigate some of the terrible practices that have been in place, you know, to try to keep it fair for their fans to access them at a reasonable price. I think the tickets now, this is 2009. I think the tickets were like $75.
Yeah.
Again,
but for front row, that would be.
That is a steal for front row.
Yeah. Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was incredible. And the Phillies were playing the Yankees
in the World Series
across the street.
Oh, my God. What a night.
It was an amazing.
Ooh, I wish I was there. By the way, Julia, real quick, what was the best song they played that night?
Well, I think the best song for me they played is a song called Rats. And it's because we had been tailgating all day long. You guys, we got down there like 9 a.m.
Oh, you got it in, Julia.
We were carving pumpkins in the parking lot. It was Halloween, baby. It was amazing.
Great call.
So it was fantastic. But because we had written, we're like, oh, we're going to be in the front row. We got to request a song, right? So we wrote on the back of a beer box in Sharpie the name of the song, Rats. And Eddie said, this is for the young lady. I was wearing a Phillies jersey and a bright red Phillies jersey in the front row. And he played that song. It was incredible. So if you listen to the bootleg, which Pearl Jam records all of their concerts and they issue official bootlegs, you can hear that little nod to me.
Nice.
So it was incredible. Yeah.
That's, a night like that for $75.
Everyone got to hear Rats. So, by the way, before we get in this conversation about Pearl Jam and Live Nation, we do have to do a disclosure, which is that Live Nation has been an underwriting sponsor for WHYY. Our programming department acts independently from our business team. So, Pearl Jam, perfect way to get into this conversation. So this is, Krista, there's been many decades of efforts to sort of rein in, Ticketmaster and Live Nation. So maybe if you could take us through that timeline real quick of how the company grew and where there have been pushback points over the years.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's notable that Julia just mentioned having a good concert in 2009, because it's the year before the merger between Ticketmaster and Live Nation, which definitely kind of spurred a lot of the changes and a lot of the issues that are being addressed in the lawsuit. But basically, kind of a slight or overview of the history is in the early 90s, so roughly 1991, Ticketmaster actually merged with this other large ticketing company called Ticketron. And that was already under scrutiny from the DOJ. Then a few years later comes Pearl Jam, and they, as you kind of mentioned, were upset by the fees and didn't like that Ticketmaster was kind of calling the shots on what their fans had to pay. So they tried to avoid using the service. They got asked actually by the administration to write kind of a complaint, and they testified in front of the Senate about kind of what they'd experienced and the harms that other artists had. And the DOJ opened an investigation similar to what's happened now, although we've made it farther this time. And inexplicably, at least seemingly from the outside, the DOJ ended up dropping that investigation. And that was kind of a huge deflating moment for artists. At the same time, there was a roll-up of promoters. So throughout the 90s, all these promoters across the country were bought by this company called SFX, which later became Live Nation. And then Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged. And now today, you know, they're still the company in power.
So there's a consolidation of promoters, a consolidation of ticket selling services, and then those two consolidations turned into one big consolidation in 2009. Is that basically what happened?
Yeah, yeah. One other thing I'll note is just that, you know, SFX, then Live Nation, actually wanted to get into the ticketing industry. So in 2008, they mentioned that they would have Live Nation ticketing. And I think Ticketmaster saw that as a threat, and they ended up buying an artist management service. And within a year, the two decided to merge. So I think they saw the risk of what competition would mean for their business. And instead of actually introducing competition, they merged into one monopoly.
And so just to be clear, so when you say Ticketmaster, Live Nation working together, they own venues, they run ticketing, they also manage artists. They kind of have their hands in everything. Is that fair?
Yes, definitely.
And so I wonder, Isabella, like how did it change? How did the impact change? Like, how did artists make money before this consolidation versus how they make money now?
I mean, what I've heard from a lot of artists and venue owners and, you know, coalitions that work in the venue, independent venue space, is that there's just a lot less choices for artists when it comes to which venues they feel like they can book their tours through, who they can use for promotion and ticketing services. Because as the government is alleging in this lawsuit, you know, they're saying that Live Nation is sort of pressuring artists like, hey, if you want to play this venue that we own, you're going to have, it has to be a full package deal where you're also going through us for promotion and ticketing. And on the flip side of that, you know, venues are really feeling the squeeze where they feel like it's a lot harder for them to work with other competitors in order to be able to host concerts that are, you know, artists that work with Live Nation, or in order to gain a wider sense of, you know, commercial viability in the market. So I think what's really happened is that we're seeing venue owners and artists and management teams feel like their choices have gotten slimmer and slimmer, and tours have become increasingly unaffordable, especially for working class artists over the last 15 years or so.
And so I wonder, you know, Krista, how does this affect the ticket prices? Because people are trying to connect, like if you have this big behemoth of a company and they have their hands in kind of everything, how does that mean that the fans then have to pay more?
Yeah. So again, kind of like a brief history, going all the way back to the 90s, Ticketmaster was the first company to give an advance to a venue to get exclusivity. And so that had not happened before. Other ticketing companies charged a fee just to provide their service, but they weren't giving these advances that were millions of dollars in the late 90s to shore up business and kind of exclusive business. So when Ticketmaster did that, it was kind of like a front-loaded kickback where they would like loss lead, pay money to a venue, and then push up the fees for the artist or for the fans to remake that money and basically make a profit on that side. So fees historically didn't actually have to do with buoying this exclusive business, but now because they're paying at this point billions of dollars for exclusivity, not only in venues, but also with artists to make sure they're the ones promoting Dua Lipa or the ones promoting Bad Bunny, they'll pay billions of dollars. At this point, I think they're $4.4 billion in non-recoupable contracts for the past year. And, you know, we're seeing that in fees.
Wow. Let me read in some comments. Rebecca from South Philly says, I do overpay often and am in pain over it. I do remember $20 tickets. Went to see Robert Plant this April at the Met. I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan, but I paid way too much. For anyone who loves 90s rock but can't afford Foo Fighters or Pearl Jam tickets, there's Pearl Jam again, by the way, come see Plush in the Box this Saturday at 118 Club in Wayne. Much cheaper, and they are amazing. So shout out to Plush in the Box. Let me bring in another caller. This is Maura from Ridley Park. Hey, Maura, you're on Studio 2. Nice to hear from you. What's your comment? What's your concert story?
Oh, my God. Thank you guys so much for covering this topic. So my 15-year-old is in love with My Chemical Romance, who I have also loved for about 20 years. I got the joys of seeing them 18 years ago, and I think I paid around $45 for the ticket. As a birthday present for my kid, I took him to go see their summer tour, and each ticket with the fees was a little over $400. For three tickets, it was over $1,300 for us to sit in the nosebleeds at Citizens Bank Park and watch them on a Megatron.
Wow.
Nosebleed seats.
Just in 18 years, the amount of money that it's costing just to see a band is outrageous at this point. I don't think in the past 2 years I've spent anything under $60 through Live Nation to see any show, even if it was a small venue.
Mm. Wow. Was it worth it, though, Maura?
To watch my kid go absolutely crazy for 2 hours, it was worth every single penny of it. But if it was just me as an adult going, I would have never have went.
Well, to do a My Chemical Romance reference, a lot of people saying I'm not okay when it comes to these ticket prices. But I am curious, Isabella, if like Live Nation is like primarily to blame for the phenomenon that Maura was describing there, which is ticket prices going way up over a relatively short period of time. Like, are there other inputs here? Are there other variables that are impacting live concert ticket prices?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, what we've seen is that there's been a big change in sort of the way that the industry works overall. Touring costs have gone up for artists. Inflation is high. I think there's sort of an affordability crisis at large in the country, and the music industry is not spared that. I've talked to, you know, Stephen Parker, who heads the National Independent Venue Association, and he says that part of it is also, especially after the pandemic, like so many people have gotten used to seeing, you know, entertainment from home, whether that's, you know, streaming movies or watching concert films. People are not going out as much. People aren't consuming as much alcohol. And all of these things sort of drive the, you know, drive down the live music experience and the revenue that is seen. The government has said that, you know, and so has the National Independent Venue Association, that they do think Live Nation's consolidation of power over the industry is mostly to blame for why ticket prices are so high. But I think it is notable that, you know, in February, Judge Subramanian, who's overseeing the trial, he dismissed several of the monopoly claims, especially some having to do with high ticket prices in particular, because he said that the government has not provided enough evidence that current ticket prices are at above competitive rates. So I think this leads back to what a lot of people are saying, which is just that overall inflation is really high. And things are just a lot less affordable now than they used to be 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, I come at this from the perspective of a sports fan. Ticketmaster controls a lot of the ticketing for sports venues, but, you know, Live Nation doesn't own the venues. They don't own the teams. Like, they don't have this, like, vast octopus style monopoly power when it comes to sports. And I've watched sports ticket prices absolutely skyrocket in much the same way. And so, Krista, I guess, what would be the argument that Live Nation is really the driver of this price escalation in the concert space when we're seeing other types of live events also cost more and more and more?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think particularly on the sports side of things, you know, one reason that I believe prices are going up, and there have been some studies around this, is just the whole structure that people can buy season tickets. And a lot of times businesses are buying season tickets. So it's not individuals paying for the bulk of the charges. It's big companies that want to be able to send their employees or do business, you know, deals at a venue. And so sports is kind of a whole other beast in itself. But that's not to take away from the argument that, you know, prices are going up everywhere. I think what's notable about the charges going on in the music space is just how much money is going to Live Nation or Ticketmaster itself. And so when you actually speak to artists, you know, Lawrence, the band who testified in front of the Senate a few years ago before all of this DOJ action, they pointed out in an op-ed that they're bringing home $6 of what they charge as a $30 ticket, and it ends up being $42 for the fans. And the $12 fee is going to Live Nation, and then the other money is going to venues, which can be Live Nation, and, you know, the other subsidiaries. So I think when you actually look at the price that we are paying as fans, mm-hmm. if you see what's going to an artist, it's pretty negligible most of the time.
And has that percentage changed over the years? Like, would we say in the 1960s, if the Who sold a concert ticket, they would be getting 75% of that revenue? Or, like, do we know if the percentage has changed much?
It has definitely changed. I can't put a number to it, but I do know that more and more so it's going to the ticketing services. And when it's Live Nation doing it, it then kind of goes to all of those subsidiaries.
Yes. And by the way, our question of the day is, tell us about your favorite concert experience. How much did you pay? Was it worth it? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebook streamers, keep those comments coming in the chat. Got to remind you, it is DJ of the day. And so if you have a song selection, please email it to studio2@whyy.org. Let's bring in another caller. We have Edith from Hatfield on the line. Edith, you're on Studio 2. What's your favorite concert experience? Tell us the deets.
Well, a lot of favorite concerts, but my most recent one was Patti Smith at the Met 2 days after Thanksgiving last year.
Okay. What was the ticket price? Was it crazy? Was it reasonable? Tell us about it.
I was surprised. The ticket price before fees was $75. I was treating a friend because that's what she and I do. We treat each other to concerts. That I thought was cool. Patti Smith also stipulated that no ticket resales, that Ticketmaster had to buy it back. If you couldn't make it to the concert, you could notify them and they would buy it back at face value. That was also to prevent scalping prices. But the outrageous thing was parking was $55. My friend was not well, and I wanted to be sure that it was not exhausting for her to get from the parking lot to the venue. And so I paid $55 for the parking. That was not top tier. $85 was the top tier, and I thought that $55 should be, you know, okay. And it turned out it was not on Google Maps, so we couldn't find the place. And it was also three blocks away.
Wow.
So
wow.
My friend who was not well would still have had to walk. Actually, I would have dropped her off and then parking and walked back.
And we got to go to a break, Edith. Edith, we got to go to a break. But thank you, Edith. And we'll follow up on some of the issues that Edith raised, because there's a lot of other gouging going on around concerts and prices. So we'll talk about that as we continue our conversation about why ticket and concert prices are so high. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. We'll be right back after the break.
Could have gotten faster on horses.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today we are talking about the state of the live music industry and how Live Nation and Ticketmaster came to dominate. Next, we're going to hear about the local impact and how musicians, venues, and fans are adapting.
We'd love to hear from you at home, on the road, and elsewhere. Tell us about your favorite concert experience. How much did you pay? Was it worth it? Email studio2@whyy.org. You can also call 888-477-9499 if you're streaming on YouTube or Facebook. Put a comment in the chat.
And by the way, callers, we'll get to you in just one moment. But joining us for this part of the conversation, we have Chris Perella, owner and operator of Rising Sun Present and Ardmore Music Hall. Chris, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Chris, you've been booking and promoting for 16 years. What's the biggest change you've seen in the industry?
Well, COVID was a real inflection point, and I think ever since, the entire industry has been dealing with rising costs that have really made it difficult for touring to be sustainable. And I think that has hit both the artist side and the venue side in a way that no one has quite figured out how to solve.
Yeah. What are the biggest cost pressures acting on you right now, Chris?
On the venue side, I would say higher labor costs, astronomical insurance costs, increases in rent, costs of food and beverage have all gone up significantly via inflation, and that's made it difficult to maintain enough revenue to offset it. And especially for a small independent club who's kind of fighting for their place in the competitive market, we want to keep prices competitive for fans, but it's difficult to do that without losing money.
Yeah, and you talk about being an independent venue. How about independent artists? I wonder who's being affected most by these rising costs. Who do you think it's hit the hardest by this?
I think that artists and venues alike are facing challenges because venues have to increase the expenses that we're recouping on shows just to be able to survive. The result is that artists either make less or need to sell more tickets to make the same amount. And meanwhile, on their end, the cost of gas, hotels, food, flights, and you name it, have all gone up substantially. And so I think you're seeing a lot of bands either call it quits or really scale back how much they're touring and how much they're able to hit smaller towns, smaller markets, which obviously is a detriment to fans all over the country. And it's not quite clear what the roadmap out of that is, especially because a lot of small clubs make their money at the bar and alcohol sales trends are down nationwide. So it's a bit of a puzzle.
Yeah, people are drinking less. And so for artists who might find it unaffordable to tour, is there any other way for them to make money? Because we also hear you get so little from every stream from Spotify. Mm-hmm. People don't really buy albums. I mean, I guess some people buy albums, but not as many people buy albums. If you're not touring as an artist, how are you making money?
It's not easy. And my experience and expertise is definitely in the live sector. So the recording and, label side of things is a little bit outside of my wheelhouse. But I know that for independent and smaller acts that are on tour, a lot of them are having to get creative with VIP programs that are offering kind of their core audience a little bit more direct access and a view behind the curtains to be able to upcharge and make some more revenue. There's more creative merchandising. There's still some live streaming opportunities. But we're also seeing, especially at Ardmore Music Hall, a move toward more and more multi-night residencies in smaller rooms. And I think that part of that is that artists enjoy the energy of a smaller room if they can make the same amount of money as a bigger room. Part of it is that the costs to operate a club like Ardmore Music Hall are a fraction of what a 2,500 cap venue would look like. And they can set up shop for 3 or 4 days and reduce the cost of all of the travel and other touring expenses that they incur. So
Money if you're staying put. Well, thank you so much to Chris Perella, owner and operator of Rising Sun Presents at Ardmore Music Hall. Great local perspective. Thank you, Chris, for your time today.
Thanks so much.
And we want to bring in a different voice, CF caller, Ricky from Philly's on the line. Ricky is a indie musician in the scene. Ricky, you're on Studio 2. Would love to get your perspective.
Hey, yeah, thanks so much for having me. So like you said, I am a independent musician in the Philadelphia area. I play predominantly alternative music, and the DIY scene, specifically for alternative music, that's, stuff like hardcore, metalcore, that sort of thing, is still very much flourishing on the underground level, predominantly through independent bookers at venues like in Philadelphia, Silk City, Firehouse, that sort of thing. I have friends from all over the country, Seattle, Denver, who tour and come through cities like Philadelphia, cities like New York, bigger cities, booking predominantly through these smaller venues, but with independent promoters. So,
and let me ask you a quick follow-up, Ricky, since you're an indie musician, but if fans want to support you, what are the ways you make money? If a fan said, wanted to say, look, I like Ricky, I want to make sure Ricky's getting my money and Ricky's getting paid. Well, how can they support you? What are the concrete ways they can show love to you?
So the best way for independent artists now who are not signed to major labels or who are signed to smaller indie labels, the best way to financially support them is through merch sales. Predominantly, that's the most income that comes from a tour, even for an indie band or for a DIY band. Really, streams are not really the way to do it anymore. Unfortunately, platforms like Spotify, Apple Music, that sort of thing, don't really make any financial impact for a musician. It's predominantly through merchandising.
Nice. Got it. T-shirts, a lot of posters. T-shirts, posters, all
Ricky,
that.
By the way, what's your stage name or your band's name?
So my band's name is actually Lina. That's L-I-N-A.
Okay.
We have a song called Soft Spoken. If you want to look us up, we are on Spotify. We are on Apple Music, mostly just for exposure reasons.
Yeah.
Mostly so people can hear us.
All right, Lina, check them out. Thank you so much, Ricky. I want to reintroduce our guests this hour, Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR music reporter, and Krista K. Brown, senior correspondent on the corporate investigations team at the Capitol Forum. So we just heard a lot of perspectives.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious now, Isabella, what could the government get out of this Live Nation case as a resolution, like a best case scenario for the folks who don't like Live Nation? And then what would be the downstream impacts of that best case scenario on the industry writ large?
I mean, I think what they're hoping for is to break up Live Nation and Ticketmaster. That also requires them to ask a jury to undo a merger that they approved 15 years ago, which is that's an uphill battle. In terms of making that claim in the courtroom. I think if that does happen, that allows more competition in the ticket marketplace, and more competition will inherently probably impact prices for fans. It will allow venues and artists to work with a wider array of promoters, ticketing services. I think it really opens up the market, and that as a result could lead to lower ticket prices. But we have to see whether, that's going to be possible for them to make the case to break up the two companies.
Yeah, let's bring in another caller. We have Ryan on the line. Ryan, you're on Studio 2. What's your perspective?
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me. I'm actually a former Live Nation employee, and I'm a current artist in Philadelphia, so I have a couple of different perspectives. And I just wanted to piggyback on what Chris from Ardmore Music Hall was saying, which I've performed there, and I love that place, so I'm glad to hear him. And Ricky, the local independent scene is very strong. I work at a venue that has about a 500 cap, and we see a lot of bigger artists that I end up working with and doing sound for that you would maybe have been at larger venues, but now they come through there because they connect with the local promoters. My venue is called Warehouse on Watts is where I work. Places like Silk City and the smaller independent venues are actually doing very well. And, you know, that's really the focus of these independent artists that are going to struggle really hard, that don't have the big budgets that the big artists have. Those are the places they have to kind of connect with. And they can put tours all over the country if they do a little legwork.
Yeah. But let me ask you a follow-up, Ryan. So what's the trade-off there for, like, an artist who maybe would have played in 1,000-seat venues, now doing a 500 indie venue? Like, so I guess the trade-off, and maybe tell me if I'm wrong, they play the 500 indie venue, they get to keep more of the revenue, but they're going to sell fewer tickets. Is that the basic economic trade-off there?
Yeah, well, if you look at the cap of the size of the rooms, like our we have two rooms at our venue, but the big room is 500. So, of course, you have to look at the general revenue that, you know, yeah, it's 1,000, 1,200 cap room is obviously going to do that. There are other streams of revenues that, you know, artists have to currently work with in the post-COVID era. The streaming merchandise sales is big. You know, you don't sell records anymore. Radiohead started giving their music away for free a few years ago. Like, how are you going to compete with that? You know, but what you can do is you have to find all these other streams of revenue as an independent artist. I will say also, it would be great to see this whole thing with Live Nation. I mean, it's unreal. I've been yelling this from the mountaintops. People who know me personally know I've been yelling about this Live Nation Ticketmaster merger for a long time. And, you know, you could split that company up into three separate companies. Do the numbers. They've made $3 billion a couple of years ago. Split that up into $3 billion companies, force them to compete, drive ticket prices down, you know, and destroy the monopoly. That's what needs to happen.
Thank you so much, Ryan, for that comment. We've been getting some great perspectives today. So, Krista, I wanted to bring you back in the conversation because I still had questions about what Judith said about the $55 parking. Yeah. You go into a concert. I mean, a bottle of water is $8. You know, you get something to eat. I mean, you're going to spend like $100 in addition to the concert ticket and all these things. Who's making this money? I just want to talk about the different streams of sort of getting money from fans within these venues and how, if Ticketmaster and, you know, and Live Nation were broken up, would that break that up as well, Krista?
Yeah. What I will start by saying is the artist sees none of that money. So everything that's coming in from parking, from concessions, that isn't going to the artist, which is a problem when you see, at least historically, that merch cuts were partially going to the venue. So it feels uneven for most artists. And again, like Lawrence, when they testified, spoke quite a bit about that. But in terms of a breakup, I do think that with competition, like fair competition, an artist has a lot more leeway to negotiate on terms and either say, we want some of the cut of the concessions, or, you know, the venues to actually get fans in the door instead of it being Live Nation venues for the most part, would need to drop the expense. And so just the pressure of competitive choice would kind of bring costs down.
And quick follow up, because this $55 parking, and I know I've had to pay, and it just makes me so mad. So the venue, which is usually owned, a lot of these venues are kind of owned by Live Nation as well. Are they the ones that control the parking prices too?
It ends up being contractual terms with the promoter as well. So I don't know if parking is always that way, but certainly concessions can be that way. And so it gets dispersed pretty much with every party that's not the artist.
Wow. Okay.
Eric comments and says, aging rock and roller here. Rock used to be for the masses. Ticket prices have only gotten worse and worse. I have a stub from the Grateful Dead 1989 garden show that cost $8.50.
See, Eric did it. Eric did it. We were talking about this earlier.
And I'm sure it was a great time if you can remember it, Eric. I went to see Dead & Co. at the Garden in 2017 for over $170.
But 1989, $8.50.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, no, of course, it's going way up. Okay, so I want to get on Eric's point here, Isabella. It's like, what is the cost to the music? What is the cost to the culture when going to see the Dead & Co. costs $170? And by the way, Grateful Dead did a lot of work to try to keep prices down over the years. So we got to tip the cap to them. They're not the worst offenders. But, I mean, what is the cost to the fan and to the broader culture of music when it costs that much to go see a show?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say I feel Eric's pain. The most I've spent on concert tickets was $275, also to see Dead & Co. at Citi Field. And it is absurd when it's a band that was really at the forefront of advocating for affordability, you know, in these huge shows that they did for decades. I think what happens is we see a much higher barrier of entry. We see a lot of fans who can't afford to go to shows. At the same time, we see more and more huge artists, you know, BTS, Harry Styles, announcing live streams, Beyonce and Taylor Swift doing concert films in movie theaters, because more and more people cannot get into these shows. It's hard to access the tickets because the platforms crash. The ticket prices are so high. So I think what we continue to see is like only people who have a certain amount of income can actually afford to buy tickets, afford to experience live music. And that comes at a huge cost for the culture. I mean, I think it really pushes down artist discovery as well, because I think you're way less likely to go see a band that maybe you kind of know if a ticket's $80 than when you can pay, you know, $15 and that's a nice night out with your friends, a good way to discover a new artist. I think it really diminishes a lot of scenes and diminishes, you know, both the fan and artist experience. I think it's detrimental for the live music experience. And
Ripple Isabel, effects, you
yeah,
might say.
And yeah. Isabella, quick follow-up to you, because I know you've covered some of this issue, but a lot of artists end up with these bills at the end of tours that they have yes. debt that they have to pay off, and they're having to do all sorts of things. Can you tell me some of the things that artists have to do to even cover? Like, they come home with no money and they owe.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing a lot of artists turn to creator platforms and subscription models like, you know, Substack and, you know, exclusive behind the scenes footage. I did a story last year talking to the British artist Kate Nash. She was, you know, she's still selling out the same venue she was 7 years ago, but she told me exactly what you're saying. She was going into tour trying to pay everyone in her crew a living wage, and she launched an OnlyFans. I spoke to the independent artist Lizzie Noh, who is also on OnlyFans, and they're getting all sorts of blowback for, you know, basically offering subscription tier services for explicit photos or content. But they told me that it was the only way that they could afford, you know, Kate Nash told me, within 5 days of opening an OnlyFans, all of her invoices were paid off. Mm. And it's been one of the few ways that she's been able to supplement her income and continue to tour. And she's continuing to sell out venues. It's just the money is just really not trickling back to the artists.
Wow.
All right. Well, we're getting toward the end of the hour. I got to bring in our guy, Chuck Nice.
Got to bring Chuck in.
Chuck Nice, the comedian Chuck Nice, who is one of our listeners. And I know Chuck's got a recommendation for all of you who are feeling the pain of these music prices. Go ahead, Chuck. You there with us?
Oh, we lost Chuck.
Chuck was going to say go to a comedy club instead.
He says comedy
is more affordable. One more caller here. Thomas from Westchester is on line one. Hey, Thomas, you're on Studio Two.
Yeah, hi. This is Tom from Westchester. I just wanted to let everybody know that in 1968, we used to go to Philadelphia all the time to go to concerts. And the first one I went to was Jimi Hendrix. It cost me $2. I saw him at the arena in North Philadelphia and sat on a folding chair. I was about 30 feet from him. Wow. It was a great first concert.
And now it all
Thomas
just feels like
Westchester.
A purple haze.
$2.
$2. Okay, so Krista, as we get ready to wrap up, I mean, look, again, going back to this best case scenario, you break up Ticketmaster Live Nation. How much do you think it impacts the cost curve for concert going?
It's hard to put a number to it. I also agree with the former Live Nation employee that it probably needs to be split up into three businesses. That is a very hopeful wish. I don't know that that's what will happen here. But if you look at the numbers, like, it is very clear Live Nation is using the promotion side of the business as a loss leader to shore up all the biggest artists. So they are losing money there and making it up in its other business lines, like advertising and ticketing. And so I think when you break at least that up, so the ticketing and the promotion, it will force those two companies to kind of act in an honest way and act in the same way that every other major or small promoter does and ticketing service does, because no one else can tie the two businesses together and kind of create this unfair system.
Now, if that does not happen, Isabella, is there a way that the little guys, these indie venues, the DIY folks can strike back and ultimately steal market share from the big guys? Because one of our callers was saying, look, a lot of these independent venues are thriving because everyone's so fed up with the prices. Is there a way to chip away at this that doesn't involve the government?
Yeah, and I think we're already seeing this. You know, like the caller said earlier, I think there's a lot of artists who are willing to take risks and try new things to look for other solutions and other alternatives to the existing system that we have. The artist Caroline Rose, last year, she released an album only on Bandcamp, not on streaming, or you could buy it in person. She toured exclusively independent venues. And she told me, like, maybe this isn't sustainable long term, but it's amazing to see that there's other ways to go about this. We've seen a lot of artists do this also, pulling their music off Spotify and doing telethons to boost album sales. I mean, I do think we're already seeing a wide network of artists, especially smaller independent artists, figure out ways to fight back. And I imagine we're going to continue to see that regardless of what happens with this trial.
Well, let me thank both of our great guests today, Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR music reporter, and Krista K. Brown, senior correspondent on the corporate investigations team at the Capitol Forum. Really loved your guys' insights today on Studio 2. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we had some great callers as well. So thank you all, and for the folks who wrote in. And by the way, now it is time to reveal our Studio 2 DJ of the Day song selection. Al, hit it. And that is One Way Out by the Allman Brothers from their legendary 1971 album At Fillmore East. It's a great example of a live album catapulting an artist to wider fame.
And shout out to Jess L. for being our DJ of the day and for writing in with fond memories of her dad taking her to Allman Brothers shows. And thank you to Marva and Amy and Eric and Jess and Jen for writing in with your memories as well. You guys made the show so much better today.
I know. And of course, we can't do any of what we do without our producers, Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel Mae Bryan. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer, Al Banks and Tina Calique engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gray.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. No matter the cost, we're going to keep on rocking here. That's on Studio 2. We'll talk to you next week.